Thanks for joining us again on The Opening Bell. Lots to chat about this week as we reflect on the drama and controversy of the weekend, with Warrington losing to Lara and Zelfa Barrett beating Kiko Martinez. Plus, we'll look forward to the action this weekend. David Avanesian against Josh Kelly. Finally, a Mexican crackerjack stateside, Miguel Berchelt against Oscar Valdez. We also have a Mexican fight for the ages, as are This Week in History, a book recommendation from Matt Christie, plus one or two other bits and pieces. Lots to cram in this week. Matt Christie, how are you feeling after a busy weekend?
I am feeling tremendous. I'm feeling good. Yeah, I'm feeling good. I mean, you know, in the editor's letter this week, I think, as we'll get onto, there was a lot of talking points, a lot of controversy, which is a shame when that kind of steals the headlines. But it shows how much people are still interested in the sport and want to talk about it. Let's be honest, it gives us something to do now, doesn't it?
First news line to talk about, Carl Frampton and Jamel Herring. People could be forgiven thinking that the pair of them are cursed, given the postponements and cancellations that has befallen their careers over the last couple of years. Looks like that fight is at least on hold.
It's a shame. It's a shame for all involved. That was an intriguing fight that, as we were getting closer and closer to writing previews for it, I was finding it harder and harder to call. Not a huge surprise that it's not going ahead. I hadn't seen the amount of fanfare that one might expect with a world title fight of this magnitude so close to it. So it wasn't a massive surprise. But let's look forward to it in March and we'll readdress it then.
First stop then. We're going to talk about the action from the weekend and with the scoring and criticism both of the judges' scorecards and indeed Howard Foster's dealing with the Warrington knockdown and then the fight thereafter. Matt spoke to Robert Smith of the British Boxing Board of Control to deal with all of those issues. Here's what he had to say.
Just to start with the main event, there's been suggestion that the fight went too long. What was your perception from ringside?
Well, the judges thing, I mean, I'm sitting 6 metres back behind a Perspex screen. Obviously, the people closest to the judges and the referee, I've spoken to Howard after the bout. He felt, I mean, in all but name, Josh Warrington is a world champion.
Yeah.
Howard, although obviously the boy was very hurt, Howard tells me that his eyes were clear. As far as he was concerned, his eyes were clear at that point. And in fact, when asked, he said, "I'm all right, Howard." So he spoke to him, actually saying his name, and then he decided to let it go ahead. You'll notice a couple of times Howard was a bit concerned about Josh's jaw, and he'd gone to have a look in the corner on a couple of the times that I saw, and Josh was talking, readily talking, and in fact he even said during the course of the bout he was talking as well during the course of the bout, so whether that's to his opponent or whatever. So Howard at that point felt that in the circumstances he should be given the benefit of the doubt and continue. I actually thought that he was clawing his way back into it, very difficult, very late on, but he had a reasonably decent round. I think it was the fifth or whatever, I can't remember now, to go and look at the scorecard, which I haven't got handy. But on that front, with Howard, his experience Howard has, the information he had there, the boy was, his eyes were clear. As far as he's concerned, the eyes were clear. And you've got to take all that into consideration. I suppose you also, people will maybe criticise, he was a world champion, it was an important fight for him, and, you know, other people have recovered and come on and won. So, and, you know, it's not as though Josh is not known, he's known for his resilience, etc., and Howard made the call to let it continue at that point.
There's been suggestion that if the roles are reversed and Lara was in that amount of trouble in the fourth round, the fight would not have continued. Now, what you've just said seems to... I mean, it's impossible to say. We don't know what decision Howard would have made if that situation had arose. But what you've just said, there does seem to have been some prior knowledge of what Josh Warrington is about that went into his decision to allow that fight to continue.
Well, I think that you know, these people are human, aren't they? You know, the referee's job is to make the first priority is the safety of the boxer. At that point, once he's decided that he's happy for him to continue, then other factors may come in. How is he recovering? He obviously has an experienced corner as well, who know the boy as well as anybody else. And that's not shifting any responsibility, but that's a fact you've got to take into consideration. If, you know, I would hope that if the opponent had was in a position, his eyes were clear, and he understood any instruction, etc., that fight would have continued also.
Okay, that's fair comment. Were at any point you at ringside in your role with the British Boxing Board of Control, were you uncomfortable at any point watching that fight as it developed?
I think that, you know, I was... I think, first of all, the thing that kind of took everybody surprise is the shock. I was shocked he went over as he did. But it was a good shot. You know, he was obviously hurt. But, you know, obviously his legs were stiff. You could see he was not his normal self. But he'd just been hit with a very good shot. And obviously, you know, he's not the first box to be hit like that and to get over and recover. Yeah, I'm always concerned, not just particularly that fight, but of course as the person who has to deal with these issues, I'm always concerned if anybody's in that position.
Yeah, yeah. So there won't be, Howard won't have to face any kind of hearing or anything with the board for that?
Well, I think that's early days. I spoke to him after the bout. I've spoken to him since. I'm awaiting a report to come in. I'm awaiting a report from all the officials with regard to the Barrett fight as well. So once they come in, we'll consider it and see what we need to do. But I mean, from initial discussions, he's a very experienced official. You would expect him to act in the proper way. And, you know, I believe he's a world-class official. People will say he got it wrong. People will say, you know, he gave the boy the benefit of the doubt. I mean, you know, Carl Froch was given the benefit of the doubt. Anthony Joshua was given the benefit of the doubt against Klitschko, and they recovered. There's many examples. Larry Holmes has given the benefit on numerous occasions where people have recovered and got through it. And I thought at one point, as I said, he seemed to be clawing it back, but obviously not enough.
And talking about the Zelfa Barrett Kiko Martinez fight, what was your reaction when you heard the scorecards read out? Or what was your reaction when you realised what the scorecards were?
I can tell you this. The closest people to the action in the circumstances we are now are the judges and the referee. Right? I'm 6 metres behind, 6 metres back behind the Perspex screen, and I had Barrett winning by a couple of rounds. Behind me, another 2 metres behind me, is the promoters team, Eddie Hearn, etc. And when I spoke to Eddie briefly afterwards, he said to me he thought that Barrett maybe nicked it by a round. The further you go back, TV is another 100 or so yards or whatever, metre, a fair distance back, as you know, you've been to these things. And they're in a Perspex, they're in a box in a Perspex screen. I understand they obviously had a draw or for Martinez. Then you go back over to the side at an angle, you've got the pundits like Johnny Nelson and Adam Booth, etc., and they thought Martinez won it handily. So the further we went back along the venue, the scorecards, so the opinions got closer with regard to the scores. I didn't think it was as wide as that, but I thought Barrett got it, my personal self. And the reason I thought that was Martinez for sure had a lot of industry. He walked in a straight line. A lot of his shots were hooks and swings, and a lot of them were landing on the arms and the gloves, where Barrett, as far as I could see, was landing the cleaner shots. Now, people can interpret that in many, many ways. They could go for the Martinez one, but the judges, well, you had two judges with the same score and one with a different one. So they were looking right at ringside. Now, I'm not defending anybody, but that's a fact. All right? And in fact, when I've looked at the scorecard, they've only agreed on 5 rounds out of 12. So they're all three of them have agreed on 5 rounds out of 12. So I think you can see that it was a close contest with regard to that. And also on one of the rounds, in the remaining seven, so I said 5 rounds that they all agreed on. In the remaining seven, with three judges would have had a drawn round. And on two occasions, they had a complete split where one went for the red corner, one went for the blue corner, one went for the draw.
Right.
So that indicates to me that they were close rounds. The one thing that does come up on this all the time, and I know it's been mentioned on numerous occasions, every round is a contest ultimately, and whether or wrong or right, the scoring system enables a wide round to be 10-9 or a very close round to be 10-9. So maybe that's where something needs to be changed. The judging of it or the interpretation of a round needs to be changed. You go, if it's a wide round, it's 10-8 or something, but we don't have that. We have 10-9. So as I say, a wide round is 10-9, a close round is 10-9. And that's where you get the differences of opinion.
It's funny you say that. I have literally just been writing that, in that we seem to have a lot of points to play with in the 10-point must system, yet we very, very rarely use them. So that, as you just identify there, a fighter can win a round clearly and they get 10-9, or it can be a very close round that's too close to call, in fact, and it will be 10-9 as well. And therefore the margin for error is greater. In your position, could you trigger a change of system in this, or?
Well, I think that's the issue with that would be a worldwide thing. But I've certainly stood up at sanctioned bodies conventions and said, you know, I think we need to consider a wide round being 10-8 and a knockdown being 10-7. And just because it's a knockdown doesn't mean you get a 10-8 now, because it could be a flash knockdown. You can still, you know, you could ultimately be winning the round. I mean, it happened with Mosley once, I forget it, well, Pacquiao, Mosley and Pacquiao, somebody was winning the round clearly, a flash knockdown, and lost the round 10-9 or 10-8. So, you know, you could, it's interpretation how it's used. But for sure, I think that there would be certainly some benefit, even if it's a wide round, being a 10-8. I mean, put it this way, you could win 2 minutes of any round and lose the third minute, right? But you've won ultimately 2/3 of the fight. You can't give, if I'm explaining it rightly, if you can't give the person who's won a minute of a round a third of the fight, can you?
No.
If it makes sense.
Yeah, it does make sense. And the other thing that kind of I've seen people talking about, and it's a very kind of divisive system, is open scoring. And the reason I mention open scoring is that very often we hear a judge may like a particular type of fighting. But the problem with that, in my mind, is that the fighter doesn't know what they like until the scores are read out at the end. If the scores were open, they would be, or they might be, in a position to do something about it. Is that something that we can consider in this country?
Well, we've talked about it because of WBC, haven't we? We don't permit it here. And one of the reasons we don't permit it here is there could be a crowd reaction if there was crowds at the moment. You know, that's just one of the reasons I'm a little bit concerned about it. I also think that you could get a situation where somebody's so far ahead they just get on their bike and run like the clappers and take away the endeavour in the bout. I mean, these are sort of things that come to your head straight away. You know, I quite like the fact you don't know the result until the end of it. We're not like football and rugby where you get points on the board, etc., or goals, etc., whatever. You know, we are the only sport, I think, you don't know, one of the only sports you don't know the result till the end. And I don't have an issue with that, generally. I mean, I think the thing is that you get a feeling, but I think half the problem is somebody gets a feeling that somebody's won it, and then they haven't. And I think that on Saturday, with regard to the Martinez one, a lot of people had a feeling he'd won it because of his endeavour. And I don't believe he did.
Okay. Okay, and I know that things can be exaggerated. As I said in yesterday's reaction podcast, is that these things can snowball very, very, very quickly in social media. But there does seem to be an issue in that, unlike in other sports, our perception or a viewer's perception is different to the result. It can be wildly different to the result, and that is different to every other sport, isn't it?
In my experience, if you're sitting at home watching television, you can be swayed certainly by the TV people, wrongly or rightly.
Yeah.
You know, I don't know, I mean, I haven't heard all the commentary. I've heard some of it, and I've certainly heard some of the comments afterwards, which is slightly disappointing. But, you know, you can be swayed by the TV commentary. Some people could say, well, not in this particular case, some people could say it's biased. Some people would say it's not biased. That's always something that TV commentators, etc., get thrown at them also. And I know they try to act in an impartial way, as they should. But I think that people watching on television can be swayed by the commentators.
Is there more that the Board of Control can do to stem the tide of accusations of incompetence and even worse in terms of how you react to these bad decisions and how you react to the performances of the officials?
We get the reports in. If we're concerned about any performance, etc., we act upon it. But it's a very difficult thing to do when we're dealing with opinions. And as I say, I do think there's something that seems to be being thrown up a great deal during the boxing tournaments now, because there's no crowd in there, because people who are making the opinions aren't at ringside anymore, because, you know, as I say, I'm 6 metres back behind the Perspex screen. The people behind me are two metres behind me, still looking through a Perspex screen. The commentators are further back in a box, up in the air, behind a Perspex screen. They've got the benefit of action replays, etc. The other pundits are around the corner, watching the fight at an angle. I mean, I think there's lots of combinations where people are disagreeing with results at the moment. I don't, you know, that doesn't mean it's crooked or people are incompetent. I think we're very lucky in this country where we have very, very, very good officials and very experienced officials. You know, I was talking to the boys after the show, and obviously I don't go onto social media, as you know, because I may obviously get it because people show it to me and whatever when I need to see it, but I don't go hunting for it because a lot of the time I don't agree with it. But obviously the referees could see what was coming on, and they were surprised. I have to say, they were very surprised with regard to the amount of comments coming their way. But that's the world we live in.
Yeah. Okay. All right.
I mean, you can put something out and you think it's absolutely right, and somebody comes screaming back, and you get more than one. You've got half a dozen people completely disagreeing with you, and you'll sit there and go, "What the fuck are they talking about?" Excuse the language, but what are they talking about? And I'm the same, and they'd be the same. So, you know, I do understand people's opinion, and I do respect people's opinions. But it doesn't mean they're right. It doesn't mean, you know, and I think that on the whole, I mean, as I say, I thought Barrett got it by a couple of rounds, just for his cleaner work. He certainly could have done a lot more, but I think he did it. And certainly over the last two or three rounds, etc., when he started to plant his feet a little bit, and he was catching Kiko's as he was coming in. So I thought he swung it from about the ninth round onwards, to be honest. Obviously, a lot of people would disagree with that.
What did you make of Eddie Hearn's comments afterwards when he said that due to the nature of those scorecards, particularly the 118-111 scorecards in Barrett's favour, that's going to become harder and harder to invite foreign fighters, or for foreign fighters to expect they're going to get a fair deal in the UK? I would imagine that you personally, with the amount of work you put in and how much pride you take, that's going to hurt.
Yes, course it hurts. I don't think it's helpful that people say that, although I do understand why they're saying it. But again, as I said earlier, it all stems to how the fights are scored. And if it's a, as I say, if you win the round big, you're still 10-9. If you lose the round small, it's still 10-9. So you can have a 12-round fight, which is an absolute rip-roarer, and somebody wins every single round by the smallest margin. And it looks on paper like it's a whitewash, and it hasn't been a whitewash. That's where the problem lies.
And the last question on it, in regards to the judges, are they encouraged, if a round is close, to give it one way or the other, rather than...
Yes. We want them, and on this occasion there was a number of draws, but certainly I say to people, you need to try to find a winner.
Right.
Of each round.
Okay. Does that not create a problem if there is genuine, because you very often you can be scoring a fight and you're just like, I don't know who deserves that. The fairest decision is to score it level.
I'm not arguing, because on this occasion we had level rounds. But I do feel, my opinion is that, if you can't find a winner, then fine, you get it a draw. But if you can find a winner, you've got 3 minutes there. If somebody can just do, I think half the problem is a lot of the time it's forgotten what's happened in the first minute. I've certainly been to fights where. And I forget, one of the fights I went to was Jason Cook against Lenny Dawes, I think it was. I can't remember, but Jason won the first six rounds, Lenny won the last six rounds, it was a draw, and it was screaming, it was a robbery. But everybody had forgot what had happened in the first six rounds.
Yeah, I remember that fight.
So you can that the early part of a fight can be forgotten, and which obviously is fairly understandable. But I'm not criticising anybody in particular. It's just the fact how it is, and we can get swayed by. Listen, you know as well as I do. I've watched a fight, a show in live, and then gone back and watched it on television. So it's a completely different fight.
Yeah, that is true.
If anybody in the sport, if they haven't done that, then they're not in the sport that long. Because that does happen, and I've certainly thought about that. Well, I can't remember that happening. So it is very difficult. I fully understand people being upset about it. It's not crooked, Matt. This is not crooked. This is people's opinions. If people think they're incompetent, then that's totally up to them. I don't believe they are. I believe they're given a decision honestly and for the right reasons. But I do think that fundamentally there possibly is a flaw in the system on how it's scored.
Yeah, I know. I agree with you, and I think anybody who works in the sport doesn't think for one second it's crooked at all. And I think you've identified it there. The problem, I think, is the scope for a difference of opinion, really, in the way that fights are scored, to cause absolute uproar. And I think that the scoring system. It's all well and good for me to sit here and say it needs an overhaul, it needs that, it needs this, but at the very least, I think the scoring system needs to be looked at as a matter of priority.
Yeah, and I don't disagree, and I don't. The trouble is, it's got to be worldwide. It's all very well us doing it, but it's got to be worldwide, because our officials will go abroad and they've got to use the same criteria that they use here as they would use in Nevada, or if we have an American judge come over here. It's got to be the same. It's got to be the same everywhere. You can't just change it. And maybe that's one of the reasons why it hasn't been changed. I don't know.
So much to talk about, Matt, as ever. Let's go to Warrington, first of all, and the way that Howard Foster dealt with that. A couple of lines from Robert Smith that Howard Foster related to him, that his eyes were clear. This is Josh Warrington when he went down in that fourth round. And he said to the referee, "I'm all right, Howard," and that he was talking to Lara or indeed otherwise during the fight, that he was happy, the referee, that Warrington was giving him the right signals. And essentially, that's what he has to go on.
Yeah, he does. He does. I think it's difficult to be massively critical in situations like this, as we indicated on Sunday, if Warrington had come back. And there were signs that he was starting to come back, particularly round 7 and 8, that he was starting to come back into the fight. Had that have continued, had he have managed to win a decision or managed to get the victory, then, of course, Howard Foster's decision would have been vindicated. I've looked at this a few times now, and I've got to be honest, the only conclusion I come to is the fight should not have gone past the fourth round. At some point between when Josh Warrington got knocked down and the start of the fifth round, either the referee or Josh Warrington's corner should have stopped the fight. That's my opinion on it. I think the way that Warrington was, it's the way his legs and the way his whole body had reacted to that knockdown. Even when he stood up from his stool at the start of the fifth round, his body was still not in condition. And even when he was appearing to get back in the fight, you could see that he was doing quite juttery, almost robotic movements back. He was unsteady, and that is a telltale sign that a fighter is in distress. But from Howard Foster's point of view, he was the closest to Josh Warrington. He was having several conversations with Josh when initially he was dropped, then in the corner in between rounds, and he was happy that Josh Warrington could continue. What we also have to say is that we can kind of develop the view that Josh Warrington shouldn't have continued as the fight progresses. Once Howard Foster has made that snap judgment that he deems that he's fit to continue, there was no other point in the fight up until the ninth round when it was stopped where it would have been reasonable for him to suddenly step in. That has to be, we have to take that into consideration as well. But for my mind, it should have been stopped, but these things happen in boxing, and Howard Foster, I have no doubt in my mind, made that decision feeling it was the right decision at the time.
Do you feel slightly less passionate about it, or strongly about it, a few days on, having watched the fight back again a couple of times now, than you did on Saturday night? Because I did put out on Twitter, and we're going to discuss this particularly with a view to Zelfa Barrett against Kiko Martinez, about how you watch a fight, where you watch it from, what kind of prism you're watching the fight through, either as a fan compared to someone who's actually working and focusing on it, the environment you watch a fight in it as well. All of that we're going to get into in a little more detail. But someone did come back to me on Twitter and say, regarding the Warrington knockdown, that because they were watching the fight as a fan and they were watching the fight expecting Warrington to win, that him going down in itself was so shocking that perhaps they were implying that it felt worse on Saturday than it did when they watched the fight back. Now, that also opens up the discussion that when you watch it back in replay, are you diluting the feeling of it or the reality of what happened compared to live events? So we're going to discuss that as well. I think there's a lot. This is a tentacled discussion that can go off on various tangents, and I think all of them are important to explore. But let me just ask you, having watched it back, do you feel less strongly about whether that should have been stopped or not than you did at the weekend?
Listen, I mean, even at the weekend, I wasn't raging that it wasn't stopped. I could see why at the weekend, why the referee would have allowed that fight to continue. It wasn't like Alex Del Magani, for example, last year, when I was absolutely aghast at this thing was allowed to continue. I couldn't understand how anybody would allow that fight to continue. Didn't have that at all with it. My emotions watching it a second time, although the shock was taken out of it, just looking at Josh Warrington, the state of Josh Warrington when he went down and how he reacted when he got up, irrespective of what his eyes were doing. And I think I did say in error at the weekend, his eyes were all over the place when we were talking on Sunday. Looking again, his eyes didn't appear to be all over the place. So that was just me going over the top. But his body was still telling me that fight should have been stopped. Now, It's a really, really interesting point, which, as you say, we will get on to. Now, I'm not saying I am better than anybody who watches boxing or who forms an opinion, but I have been conditioned, completely conditioned, over the years, perhaps to watch a fight in a different way to other people do, because I've always, always got to give my point of view on it. So I will watch it in a slightly different way, but you're absolutely right. When you're watching it live and you don't know what's coming, then your emotions and your judgment can be skewed by something that you're not remotely expecting. But no, I think my opinion on whether or not the fight should have been stopped has not changed at all since I watched it for the first time. What I will say is that it was a much more exciting, it was a brilliant, really, really exciting fight when I watched it a second time, where I think that there is this perception that it was a one-sided hammering. Josh Warrington played his part in that contest, even after the fourth round. Even after the fourth round. So perhaps that is a bit of a tip of the hat to what Howard Foster, allowing the fight to continue. Maybe. I mean, that's pushing it. But Warrington played his part in a really, really exciting contest.
And I think you have to remember as well, you watch back the final minute of the fifth round, Warrington is the one who's on top. He's the one who's fighting back and seemingly getting better. So it was quite a significant recovery, even from the previous round. And he was talking cogently, you could see, in between rounds as well. I must admit, I wouldn't have screamed had it been stopped. And I'm not making noise that it was allowed to go on, either by Howard Foster or by the corner as well. That's my take on it. But I can understand exactly why people might feel passionately one way or t'other. Interesting news coming out as well, Matt. I mean, there was a sort of inferred or implied or wondering thought about concussion, I think, by some people, whether it was Adam Booth or others watching from home and reacting on social media as that fight unfolded. And reportedly, Josh Warrington fractured his jaw, perforated an eardrum and a shoulder injury as well, which may have been a recurring theme. So he's going to take time to heal and mend, but he's released messages in recent days on social media avowing his intent to be back and to come back. That's something that you were sort of wondering about on Sunday morning when we posted sort of initial reflections and thoughts on it. So Warrington positively looking forward to sort of healing and rebuilding.
Yeah, I mean, it's good to hear that that's what Josh Warrington wants to do. And again, I said on Sunday that I would be surprised if we get to see the best of Josh Warrington again. And I still feel very similar to that. And again, I will reiterate, go out there, Josh Warrington, and prove me wrong. But at this stage of his career, the nature of that sustained punishment that he took, I think could play a part in his comeback. I don't think we'll see the best of Josh Warrington again. I might be completely wrong on that, and I'm very, very, very often completely wrong on these things. But the manner in which Josh Warrington was moving for the last few rounds of the fight, even though he was in it, the manner of the knockdown in the fourth, the finish in the ninth, I think it was punishment that he didn't need to take. And I think at the age of 30, if he has got a broken jaw, there's various things. He could be out of the ring now for the best part of another year. And then he's got to rebuild. It's a difficult ask for Josh Warrington. It might be difficult for him to find the motivation during some deep and dark moments in training for him to come back. And the scene is set for him to make an absolutely spectacular comeback and prove me completely wrong.
Yeah, I would be reluctant to suggest that on the back of one defeat. As damaging as that is and significant as it is in terms of the roadmap of his career, in terms of timing and the nature of the defeat. Those are both significant factors. There's no doubt about that. But I would be loath to be suggesting just yet that's that until proved otherwise. So we'll see how that unfolds. Going back to Lara, was there anything about watching the fight again regarding him that changed or developed? Because I must admit, I can't believe that the fighter that I watched in preview for the fight at the weekend is the same guy that turned up. And he was just so much faster. I'm not saying he's a world beater, and I still think that Warrington beats him at his best. But I think the punching power of Lara, when I watched it back a second time, impressed me even more than it did on the night. He, particularly the left hook, his hands way faster than they ever looked before. And I just wonder, Matt, the fact that he was getting down to featherweight, I think for just about the first time in his career. You know, you look through his results and the weights that he'd been fighting at and the weights of the opponents he'd been fighting against. You know, maybe for the first time in his career, he was properly prepared and fighting at his natural weight, as well as, of course, the sparring sessions with the WBO champion Emmanuel Navarrete, who was looking like a potential opponent for Josh Warrington, not Maurizio Lara, prior to the weekend. So any greater appreciation of Lara on the back of further viewing or not?
I didn't feel that he was any more impressive than I felt he was when I first watched it, if I'm going to be honest with you. I thought that his the difference in their punching power, or the effect that their punches had on each of them was stark. What I will say in regards to Warrington as well is that there was a perception that Josh Warrington didn't look right. What he was, I think, was overconfident. I think, but as soon as he got tagged in the first round, with the benefit of hindsight, you could say that was where the fight was lost. As soon as he got tagged, he was then trying to make up for that pretty much throughout, and he was fighting gung ho against someone who he felt that power in the first minute of the first round, Josh Warrington, and he was almost trying to stamp his authority on it again, thinking, well, hang on, this isn't right. I'm the huge favourite here. I'm the better fighter. This shouldn't be happening. And he was almost trying to readdress that balance throughout the fight. You can make an argument that Warrington maybe won rounds two. You could have an argument that he won round three. He was certainly busier, but he was wide open because of his determination to be the authoritative fighter. He was making mistake after mistake after mistake, and he wasn't addressing those mistakes. And Lara was just getting through. Every time Lara was getting through, you could see the effect of those punches. But as I said on Twitter on Saturday night, you look at the state of Lara's eye at the end of that fight, and Warrington was connecting regularly. The difference is that Lara was going nowhere. Lara was going absolutely nowhere with those punches.
Yeah, absolutely right. I thought the second round was Warrington's best round. Of course, he had that flurry where you wondered if he might knock him out early in the first as well. But as you say, there was a lack of authority and control even before the knockdown in that fourth round. So it wasn't just about the knockdown changing the fight. It did perhaps take Warrington out of it and prevent him from winning it. But there was a lack of control and authority before then, even when he'd had success in those opening rounds.
Well, exactly. And that's the point. So the fourth round, when the knockdown occurred, prior to that, Lara was having success. Warrington was struggling to... He was just overeager. He was ragged at times. He was overreaching. He was leaning in. If he was unable to find the discipline prior to the fourth round, the chances of him, you know, knuckling down after that were quite small, I thought. His game, although he was so courageous, Warrington, those mistakes that he was making early on were then magnified by the effect of the punches he took in the fourth round. I noticed that a few people gave Warrington the fifth round. A few people gave Warrington the fifth round. When I watched it back, I couldn't do that. Although he finished the round strongly, for the first minute or so, he's completely under the cosh. It was a really, really good performance from Lara. But let's not get over the top with it. There is a tendency, and it's probably not exclusive to this country, but we're more aware of it in this country because it's the country that we live in, it's the country that we work in. But there is a tendency when someone that we're not that familiar with comes over and does a bit of a job on one of our fighters to then presume that the person who did the job is a superstar in waiting, a la Goyo Vargas against Paul Hodgkinson back in the 90s, maybe even Julio Cesar Martinez against Charlie Edwards more recently. We then presume that these are going to be, you know, the next Salvador Sanchez or whatever. And that's not necessarily always the case. But what we have got now in Lara is someone who we will watch very carefully. I'd be interested to see a rematch. If I was Warrington, I wouldn't be particularly keen. Or if I was advising Warrington, I wouldn't go over the top in saying, get an immediate rematch. Getting a really big rematch. I've seen this fight compared to Andy Ruiz versus Anthony Joshua, in that Ruiz exposed Joshua on that night and did deliver a bit of a beatdown over the course of seven rounds. Joshua also hit the mat more than Warrington did. And yet, 6 months later, Joshua came back and put on a show and won pretty much 12 rounds out of 12 against Ruiz to set the record straight. For me, this was a different kind of fight. The reaction to Warrington when he was under pressure was different to Joshua. So I wouldn't be in a hurry to go back in with Lara in the next fight for Josh Warrington. I think that could be a recipe for disaster.
Okay, interesting. Although a bit like Joshua, who's maybe shop-worn by PR and press obligations, etc., maybe just went into that fight weary. And you do feel that there were lots of external factors that impacted upon Warrington being out of the ring, no fans, COVID environment, perhaps mindset, which we talked about on Sunday morning as well, overconfidence, and maybe bumping into a sleeper as well. So, like we said, the only thing I said, I wondered if weight making weaved its way in as well. I would take that out. I think that's a potentially a red herring that I just wondered about on Sunday. But everything else, that sort of perfect storm that we said of factors, I think that very much came to bear. And that was the phrase that we used on Sunday morning. So good luck to Warrington. Hope he spends time with his family, mends well, and we will learn more about Lara, I think, next time. Let's move on then to the Zelfa Barrett Kiko Martinez fight, which you and I have watched again and again. And of course, those two 118, 111 scorelines as well, next to the 116, 113 of Howard Foster. Those were the big talking points. Eddie Hearn said immediately on Sky, I think 118, 111 is absolutely disgusting. It doesn't do anyone any favours. And that seemed to mirror what many people were saying on social media, and I think both you and I were reactive as well in our own ways. And then you take time to reflect and sit about it. And it made me just think more and more again about how it is that fights are scored, both by those ringside in the arena and those watching at home on television. And I think there's an awful lot to discuss. I must admit, watching it back, Matt, there were only five rounds out of the 12 that I could be reasonably confident of giving to one man or another. That's five out of 12 rounds. And those were two, for what it's worth, 2-5 and 8 to Kiko and 1-9 to Zelfa. However, of there were three rounds that I really struggled to split them, rounds 3, 4, and 10. And then there was three rounds, floating rounds, that I were leaning towards Zelfa, and there was only one floating round I was leaning towards Kiko. So in other words, the majority of the floating rounds I was actually going towards Zelfa Barrett, and there were three rounds where I literally couldn't split the pair. And because of the stylistic matchup, I do think that perhaps was exaggerated. So I think, in summation, it was a very, very difficult fight to score and a close fight to score. Watching it back, how has that affected what you thought on the night?
I've watched it three times now. I watched it on the night, as obviously live with commentary. I watched it again on Sunday, and I watched it again this morning with in complete silence. Just watch the action. And yeah, I think there's something like six or seven rounds. So kind of, you mentioned there was only five where you could be certain on who won it. And I think I've made a note here of one, two, three, six, where I've said it could really have gone either way. So that's really, really, that shows how difficult it was to score. What I will say is that every time I've scored it, I haven't come anywhere near the 118, 111. Each time I've scored it, twice, I've scored it level. Once I scored it 114, 114, and once, because I gave an extra round left, I scored two rounds level rather than trying to go one way or the other, I scored it 115, 115. And then I think there was another time where I scored it for Martinez, 115, 113. The difficult thing here is that, and, you know, we've said this many times, we've heard Rob Smith say it many times, is that a fight can appear close when watching it, yet the scorecards, just by how far apart they are, will appear to tell a story of a fight that has been dominated by one person. That isn't always the case. All I can presume that happened here, as Rob Smith kind of identified, is that every single close round the judges gave to Zelfa Barrett. It, of course, does beg the question, why do they give every single close round to Zelfa Barrett? Now, it might just be that they felt that every single close round was edged by Zelfa Barrett, and if that's their opinion, then that's their opinion. Watching the fight back, what did strike me as well is that when Martinez was on top, it was more dramatic. Because of the way that Zelfa was boxing, off the back foot, going round and round the ring, is that when he was caught, he often stumbled, he often found himself tangled in the ropes. There were times where he was dabbing his face and looking at his glove to see if there was blood or whatever. He was kind of more vocal to the referee to object to anything. So he was often giving the appearance of the fighter who was more in distress more frequently in the contest. When Barrett was having success, Martinez, like the raging mad little lunatic he appears, was not budging because he was constantly moving forward. So when there were the rat-a-tat combinations that were landing on the inside from Barrett, Martinez was more or less brushing them off and going forward. So they did not appear as dramatic as the moments of success that Martinez was having. That can play a part in it. We mentioned the commentary. Now, more educated voices may say that the commentary has no effect on their perception of the fight. It's very, very difficult, though, for the commentary to have no perception of your view of the fight, particularly when the commentary is in agreement with your own opinion. It's almost like your own opinion is being validated, therefore your opinion becomes stronger and your opinion becomes fact. Not saying that is always the case, but it's interesting to note that after five rounds, I think Andy Clark had Martinez 4-1 up. Matthew Macklin had him quite a long way ahead as well. And I think they went to Dave Caldwell at one point, who also said that he had, I think he said he had Martinez edging it, and he was kind of illustrating some of the faults that Barrett was making and some of the success that Martinez was having. All of this can, I'm not saying it does for everybody, but it can play a part in your perception of the fight. Going back to what I said at the start, and again, please don't think I'm coming all high and mighty. I do make a very, very conscious effort to try and watch every fight as objectively as possible, and I will score it, and I will. But you know, I will try to retain my own opinion without the commentary, but I can't sit here and say for certain that the commentary doesn't have any effect on me. I just don't know. But again, going back, after watching it again this morning, I'm coming up with more or less the same score. More or less the same score every time. It's a really, really close fight. And for me, that's where we might have a problem. Because if the vast majority of people are watching consistently come up with a different result to what is the actual result, then that's where the stink is created. And that's where perhaps that we need to go back in and reevaluate the system. Whether we need to go in and reevaluate how the rounds are scored in terms of, do we need to be using more of those 10 points? Do we need to have somebody in the Sky commentary who is a licensed judge, or someone that was a licensed judge, or something like that? I don't know. But the viewpoint of us at home and our method of scoring it, whether that's me or you or Joe Bloggs or whoever, is wildly different to the judges. So, as the point that I make in this point's boxing news, when we then when we attempt to analyse or criticise the judges' scorecards, or we attempt to analyse or criticise the judges' performances or the referees' performances, we do so from our own position without having any kind of experience or idea of where of what they're seeing or what they or their experience at that time. Their position, unlike everybody else's who watches, is completely unique.
I think fans, I think we have to be absolutely honest with ourselves about how it is when you're watching a fight at home on TV, how you're watching that. And I'll stick my hand up. On Saturday, I watched it as a fan. I didn't have pen and paper down. I do that for fights, but I didn't at the weekend. I wanted to enjoy it. I just watched it, knowing that I was going to watch it back a second or a third time with pen and paper and make notes both on scoring, on the pattern of the fight, questions that it raises for me, and things I'd like to ask you or whoever. At the weekend, I just watched that as a fan. So I'm kind of scoring it ongoing, not necessarily accurately, but just ongoing. And it's a moving picture, isn't it, when you watch as a fan? It's not a put a number down on a piece of paper, pass it on, move on to the next. Put a number on a piece of paper, pass it down. You're watching it. You might be slightly distracted at some point. You might be getting up for a beer. Who knows? But the way, and I'm not saying the way that anyone watches a fight isn't valid or worthy. Of course it is. You watch the fights however you watch the fights. But be honest with yourself. And I'm saying, I watched that at the weekend as a fan without pen and paper. And I was thinking in my head, that's 7-5 Kiko or 6-6. I had it a close fight. But when I watched it back with pen and paper, with the sound down, I had on Zelfa's side more of those floating rounds on his side of the paper than I did for Kiko. So I can understand why someone who is focused and concentrating from 3 to 6 feet away, ringside, who is doing a job as opposed to just watching it for pure enjoyment, as I was as a fan, might get a different result to the one that I saw at the weekend. And if I was putting numbers down today, then I would have a different setup to the one that I did at the weekend. And that's been absolutely honest. So if I'm doing that, fans need to do that about how you watch a fight and whether or not that's absolutely 100% accurate compared to a judge who is ringside. And I thought it was interesting. I'm not supporting or defending the judges, Robert Smith or whoever. I'm just trying to explore this as an avenue of discussion. And there was an interesting point there for Robert Smith, just about those people that are in the arena. And I think it is an important point in the COVID environment, because I think things have changed in terms of how people are allowed to watch the sport. We're not all ringside there anymore. And I can speak, having been to half a dozen or so MTK shows last weekend, and I'm going to be ringside again on Friday night. And the fights I've done, I'm probably closer, I think, than I think Sky and have been at some of their shows and were at Wembley. And I think Robert described it. He said, obviously, that the judges and the referees the closest with the fighters. Then the judges are on the ring apron, which is where me as a commentator and Adam Smith and Andy Clark and Matt Macklin and whoever, that's normally where they would be. But in the current climate, they're pushed back further than they would be normally. So I think Rob was saying that the closest to action judges and the ref, obviously, then he himself and some of the officials from the board are next in line. He said Eddie Hearn, as a promoter, is in behind him. Then the TV, Rob said 100 yards. I think he meant 100 feet. The TV commentators were then further back in behind him. And then the Sky panel are further back beyond them. And he said, interestingly, the scores, which started off ringside, Rob said he had, you know, maybe two to Zelfa Barrett. Then Eddie, one layer back, had it maybe Zelfa by a round. And then you get back to the commentary who have it, you know, Kiko, and then the Sky panel who have it, Kiko. So you almost get this, diluted would be the wrong word, but you get a different and maybe slightly exaggerated impression of the fight just by those people who are there. Never mind people who are watching it at home on TV like I was at the weekend. And I thought that was really interesting regarding just those people there and the impression they have relative to the actual view that they have. And there has to be, if the commentators are further back. And I spoke to Andy Clark about this this morning, who was commentating at the weekend for Sky. And that was something that Andy was mentioning and wondering about as well, in terms of your impression and what that is like compared to what it would be normally like in a non-COVID environment.
Yeah, it's that they're all really, really interesting points. And I think that where you're sitting can wildly affect your perception of a fight. And I've been, over the years, I've sat many times on the ring apron when I've been working for Boxing News, generally at the small hall shows. Often you'll get to a small hall show, often at York Hall, Brighton. A few times when I've covered the fights at Brighton, they've just stuck me at ringside, like right on the ring apron. You get a completely different perception there than you do a few rows back. You get I've also sat up in the gods. I've sat all over, and it does give you a completely different perception. My own point of view on that, in terms of what is the best view, there is two that stand out as being the best view. There is one when you're right on top of the ring, and the other one is when you're watching on television. Those, for my mind, are the two best. You can be six or seven rows back, and because of all manner of things, your perception of the fight or your enjoyment or your view can be skewed. But the difference, I think, and it's what you highlighted, is that if when we're watching the fight, how many of us, hand on heart, honestly, can say that we're watching the fight with view to scoring it? How many can honestly say that? And that, I think, is the difference. Now, again, I'm not justifying this score. I will go on the record as saying I think the 118, 111 score lines for Zelfa Barrett were way off. I still think that. I struggle to come to that conclusion. But before everybody goes wild and loses their mind about it, can they honestly say that they've spent the last 36 minutes of action purely with just with a view to scoring the fight? That is perhaps where the perception does become completely skewed. However, I still think that the system is not right. I'm not saying it needs an overhaul. I'm not saying that. But for example, we have just mentioned there that there were five rounds. There were five rounds there that you were confident in five rounds of giving them to one fighter or the other. So if you're confident in giving them to one fighter or the other, make that a 10-8 round. You're confident in that. And if you think that someone has edged it, make that a 10-9 round. If someone has absolutely had a bombastic round, make it 10-7 or 10-6. But the crucial thing in this, and I'm not saying this is the solution, this is something that Robert Smithy says has got up and spoke to sanctioning bodies about himself. The crucial thing is that this is uniform throughout the world. This is uniform throughout the world. Because if you have some, for example, if after two rounds you have someone that has just spent 3 minutes bashing, say fighter A has spent 3 minutes bashing fighter B all around the ring and wins it 10-9, then the next round it's really, really close and perhaps fighter B has edged it. That's 10-9. So after two rounds it's an even fight. Is that right? Is that correct? I'm not convinced it is. What I'm saying is that there's scope here to really dig deep and analyse what we're doing, what we're doing. But it does, and this speaks of a broader issue, is that if we start doing it in Britain, it's going to take years and years and years for the rest of the world to catch up. This is why we have, you know, this speaks of another problem with not having an umbrella group that makes the rules and regulations all over the world.
I'm not sure that's the right answer. And I know Rob mentioned that. He said, you know, perhaps there is a fundamental flaw in the system, was exactly the phrase that he uses. And I'm not sure that flexibility in the 10-9, 10-8 or 10-7 scoring, I'm not sure that's the answer. And the reason is this is this fight is a perfect case in point, because those five rounds, you were more confident, but you're not absolutely certain. And to give those as 10-8s, even if you did that, Matt, I still had only three of those to Kiko and two of those to Zelfa. And then you go back to the floating rounds that then become 10-9s, and I had more of those going to Zelfa. So I'm not sure that's the answer. I see the practicality in it. I just don't see the functionality in it. I think close fights like these, this is a case in point for why boxing is always going to be the way it is. I think I just don't see that flexibility going forward with the scoring as being the answer. Not in a fight like this.
I hear you. No, I do hear you. I hear exactly what you're saying. And perhaps this fight isn't the best example to use it. But my point of view has always been, why have we got a 10-point must system? Why have you got a 10-point must system?
Do you know what occurred to me, Matt, as being perhaps, and this will be seen as a regressive step for many, but because I think there were reasons for getting away from the half-point system and then trying to move on to the 10-point must system. But there was something else that Rob said that just struck a chord with me. And you asked him, do you encourage, judges to find a winning round? And he said, yes, our judges are encouraged to find a winning round. And that, for me, is the root of the problem. Because if you've got seven rounds, as I had at the weekend, out of 12, where I really struggled to find a winner in that round. If you've got more than half a fight where, you know, it's small margins which you're leaning towards one fight or another. If that's the case, then you shouldn't be doing it, in my mind, because that's a flip of a coin, or you're dealing with very small margins. And I don't think those margins are enough to be there for turning a fight around or exaggerating a result like we had in this instance, or it seemed like we had in this instance.
Yeah, no, that again is exactly why I asked that question. It's exactly why I asked that question. There is, you always feel like you have to give it to someone, yet very often you can make the wrong call by doing that, or it can lead to very, very misleading scorecards after a close fight. Everywhere in the world, pretty much, is of a similar opinion. There's certain countries where you'll see these scorecards like 118, 116, and things like that. But they're very rare. By and large, the world is encouraged. The world's officials
Before social media, Matt, did were your letters, pages, and emails crammed with fallout from contentious decisions?
When I went back, and I mean, this is the thing, and this is what everybody kind of has to keep in mind when they're ranting and raving about the state of boxing today. I took enormous pleasure the year before last in compiling our bookazine, the 110 years of boxing news. And during that process, I spent days and days and days going through old issues, looking for fight reports, but also looking at letters pages and the opinions. And many of the opinions on those letters pages, although admittedly they were articulated somewhat more effectively and a little bit better, are very similar to what you see on social media now, in that there's grumbles with, you know, even in the 1920s, there's people complaining that there isn't one overruling body looking after the sport. There's confusion about this champion. You know, we look back at people like Lee Savold in the 1950s being declared the world champion by the British Boxing Board of Control after he'd beaten Bruce Woodcock and causing all sorts of confusion. All these issues have been going on and on and on and on and on. But then, of course, but we're not in those eras anymore. And my point with the scoring system now is that surely, although you say this is, I think that there is too much of a temptation to say, well, this is boxing, this is what we've got to deal with, we need to make the best of it. I'm not of that train of thought. There's a lot of people that are. I'm not of that train of thought. There has to be something we can do about this in this day and age. Surely there has to be something that we do about this, about the constant scoring controversies. We can't have it right at the moment. This cannot be right at the moment. We need to rethink. We all need to, maybe we need more people going in and analysing different ways that we can do this. I don't know. But I don't feel that this is the be-all and end-all. This is the end game. This 10-point must system, three judges at ringside, this is how it works. Then you either like the decision or you lump it, and that's the way it's going to be forever. As with anything, we're in a state of evolvement. We're moving, we're learning. Let's learn from where we are at the moment, and let's sit down and see how we can improve things. If you start to believe that we can't improve things, then we're in a bit of trouble.
Okay, fair enough. I'm not saying it's just boxing. I think it's just the nature of the sport, viewing it and scoring it and interpretation. That's my take on it. But I'd welcome, and we welcome your thoughts as ever, folks. If you want to tweet us or get in touch, the opening bell podcast at gmail.com with your thoughts on how fights could be scored better. Get in touch with us on that. Couple of points just to finish up with. One, just going back to how fights are commentated on in the COVID environment. And as I said, I was been thinking about this a lot, and speaking to Andy Clark of Sky about it earlier on this morning as well. And that one other thing I just wanted to point out, the difficulty, I think, for a commentator now at a boxing event in the current climate is when you look to the ring and when you look to your monitor. Now, I've been lucky enough in on the MTK shows, I'm close enough, although I'm behind a Perspex screen, I'm close enough that I can mainly watch the action from the, unless I'm obscured by the referee or whatever, I generally can look at the ring. But sometimes I think they are far enough away where that's a decision you've got to make, whether you're actually looking at the monitor and therefore you're looking at what people view at home as opposed to what you might have normally seen ringside. So that was one point I wanted to make. And the other point, just to finish off, Matt, do you feel watching back a second or a third time is a more accurate reflection of what happened, or just a different one, or a considered one, or just an enhanced one, or whatever?
I think overall, you kind of enhance your understanding of a fight the more times you watch it. And I think it's really only an exercise for people that are putting together a weekly boxing magazine or a weekly podcast. You're not going to get your average punter go back and sit there and keep spending hours and hours rewatching the same fight over and over again.
And that's important. It's not a criticism, but I do think that's important, because I think the way that we remember things as human beings, and the easiest way to remember things, certainly in boxing events, if they go 12 rounds, very difficult to remember all that, you know. You'd often, Matt, you'll know that you want to refresh your memory on fights. You'll have to go back to your notes to go through individual rounds to remind you about certain points. And what you tend to do is you nutshell what happened. You know, the Warrington fight, you remember, oh, Warrington, you know, he looked like he might knock him out in the first. He was all but knocked down in the fourth, spirited comeback, and then knocked out in the ninth. That'll be your four bullet points on that fight. And that's how you remember things. But it's not necessarily the full story. And there are little bits that join the dots in between. So I do think it's important. And I would urge, I know it's difficult, because sometimes you think, I'm like that when I have to do it for work, where I think, God, I've got to watch back on that fight again. But I do think it's important. I really do think it's important for your understanding of what happened, as well as your ongoing appreciation of the sport. So let's just wrap up on this, because you literally could do four podcasts on scoring. And you and I have disagreed on just about everything so far today. So let's let's try and sum up on this. You'd like to see... So, you know, Robert Smith said, you know, maybe there's a fundamental flaw in the system. You feel likewise. You're sensing we need to be proactive. There needs to be some. What are you thinking? How does this move forward?
I'm sorry. I just actually turned back then. And as I turned round, the wire went out of my headphones and I didn't hear the full question. I heard you say, so to sum up, and then it went quiet, and then I heard you say, proactive, what are you thinking?
Yeah,
I don't know.
How does, if you want to take this scoring debate forward, you want to see a change to the perceived flaws in the system, what are the, going to beyond the full picture, what are the bullet points that we need to be looking at?
I think we need, as I've said before, I think we need more transparency from the board. I think it's always beneficial to hear the point of view of the judges after a fight. I think there needs to be a re-evaluation of exactly what we can do in terms of the 10-point must system. I think the perception of the 10-point must system is already, if the round is scored 10-8, then that's going to be a massively wide round. So to reevaluate that thinking would be really difficult. So do we need to come up with a different scoring system in it? But ultimately, why are we using all these points? So for me, the 10-point must system, and this has been something that I've had in my mind for years and years and years, that there must be something else we can do with that. Do we need to think about open scoring? Is that something? Now, I completely, completely take on board that can absolutely kill the drama stone dead, open scoring. But in, say there'd been open scoring on Saturday night and Kiko Martinez was well aware that he was losing, would that have been fairer on him than him getting to the end of 12 hard rounds and finding out that the judges had barely given him a sniff of any of the action?
Yeah, I see.
These are all things. I think there need to be. I mean, let's not get into open scoring, because I can see you don't. You're not. I'm not saying I'm for open scoring. What I think there needs to be is more of a discussion about these things. What I will say in defence of the British Boxing Board of Control is they've got their work cut out just to keep on top of various things, let alone bringing in sweeping changes. I guess I just think that we need to be open to change. And that brings in mind that the media in general, that's whether it's the print media, whether it's the way that fights are broadcasted in terms of the teams that are involved who are analysing the fights, and also the British Boxing Board of Control. Because the British Boxing Board of Control, and I say this with the greatest respect for Robert Smith, will often come back and say, well, yeah, this is how we scored it and why. But there is very rarely any kind of admission that perhaps they were wrong on that occasion. There is always a presumption that it's the people at home that are watching it that got it wrong. It's a really, really difficult one. But I think as a matter of priority, because we can't keep having these absolute stinks after the majority of events. And you're right, it does seem to have increased during COVID times. It does seem to have increased. But I also think it's that more and more people have a platform to speak on social media. I'm not saying those people that have that platform are saying the wrong things. I'm not saying that. But there's more and more people now who are injecting their point of view into the whole debate. And it's going to be very, very difficult to manage. But I suppose, ultimately, what this highlights, surely, is that the judges are seeing different fights. So there's three people seeing different fights to hundreds of thousands that are watching on the telly. That's a real, real problem, isn't it? Unless that somehow we all become educated on what those three judges are seeing. Really difficult, really difficult. But there's so many talking points that I think we need to have, and hopefully we can have with the British Boxing Board of Control.
Yeah, and hopefully we've kind of nudged at a few of them. And it's not to say that, you know, there's plenty of people who I follow or read on social media who've been sort of vocal on this. And that's not to say they're not reading the situation right. And that's not to say that they're not reading fights right. Maybe they are. So, listen, we will revisit this on another time. This weekend, we've got boxing on both sides of the Atlantic as the season really sort of kicks up a gear. David Avanesian against Josh Kelly, finally. Is there a difference between Kelly, the otherworldly, talented gym fighter, to the one that we've actually seen in the ring? What Josh Kelly, are we going to see turn up against Avanesian as the one that we've seen so far in the ring who's got sublime skills but seemingly hasn't quite slotted it all together yet? Up in class on the biggest stage, is Kelly going to deliver?
I don't know. That's the beauty of this fight. I think you've got Josh Kelly, who's 6-5 favourite. You've got Avanesian News even, so it's really, 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 really tight, this one. I genuinely don't know which way it's going to go. I think that having seen Josh Kelly as an amateur and his progression as a professional, there is a lot of talent there. I thought when he fought Ray Robinson on the biggest stage of his career so far, on the undercard of Joshua Ruiz in New York, Madison Square Garden, June 2019. He looked at times to be overly reliant on that flash and panache and skit and everything else. And he was, if not exposed, he was taught some lessons in that fight. That's a long time ago now. We know he's fought Winston Campos since then. And again, he didn't set the world on fire in the way that we've been told that he will. There's still time for him to do that. But we have seen fighters go through their entire career without ever reproducing that gym form, that amateur form, in the professional ranks for whatever reason. Not saying that's going to happen with Josh Kelly. What we might see on Saturday, because this is the big stage for him now, is that he puts on a masterclass. And what we perceive to be the best of Josh Kelly should beat what we perceive to be the best of David Avanesian. The difference, of course, is that we've seen the best of David Avanesian several times in a professional ring. We have not yet seen the best of Josh Kelly. So do you therefore make Avanesian the favourite because of his accomplishments and what he's done? Or do you side with the potential of Josh Kelly? I mean, if you're going to talk to Adam Booth, I mean, out of all the fighters that he's nurtured and trained, he will tell you that Josh Kelly is right up there at the top with the most talented fighters he's ever worked with. And if you look at the fighters he's worked with a lot of talented fighters. And I think there's only really David Haye that he'd put up there with Josh Kelly. The stage is set for Josh Kelly to produce. Wouldn't surprise me massively if Avanesian won this fight.
No, not at all. Promise and potential versus achievement and substance. Looking forward to seeing how that one boils down. Even more so, I've got to say, I'm really looking forward to the MGM over the weekend in the bubble. And that's Miguel Berchelt against Oscar Valdez. This for the WBC super featherweight title, being defended for the seventh time, should be the eighth, but there was one sort of COVID climate, no contest defence in Mexico that hasn't been registered for Berchelt. He has been terrific, and Valdez unbeaten, of course. And with this in mind, Jamie Ingleby got in touch. It was actually the other week before Warrington, but it's still pertinent. And he said he's really looking forward to Top Rank kicking off 2021, offering the next instalment of an all-Mexican war in Miguel Berchelt against Oscar Valdez for a title that has seen some of the greatest Mexican wars throughout the years. Chavez, Martinez, Barrera, Morales, more of that in this week, folks. And more recently, the aforementioned Berchelt to Vargas, their two fights, which were crackers, all of which have been delivered with classic toe-to-toe action and a must for any rainy day YouTube session. Yeah, amen to that, Jamie. Berchelt against Oscar Valdez. Bruchelt has got absolutely the lot, and some of the stateside, what are they, Behind the Ropes or whatever it is, the US Progress, it's another program, I can't remember the name of it, in the build-up to this are compulsive viewing. And Valdez, of course, up at Super Featherweight. This is intriguing. Valdez has got, and I think relies on, that superb speed of hand. I think he makes little mistakes, and Bruchelt does everything so well, and he hits so hard that I just favour him, but that the speed of Valdez potentially could pose him some problems. This, potentially, Matt, is one that's going to go down in the history books.
Yes, I know. This could be the start. This could be the start of something really, really special. Well, we say the start. They've got history, haven't they? They go back to their amateur days when Valdez was kind of the darling of the Mexican amateur team at that point. Whereas Bichelt wasn't put forward. You know, he lost to Valdez as an amateur. He then struggled to nudge ahead of Valdez for the major tournaments. Bichelt has been keen on this fight ever since, he says. 30 years old, Valdez, 28-0, Bichelt, 38-1. I think I tend to agree with you on this. I think that Valdez still makes mistakes in a way that Bichelt doesn't. Now, since he's been working with Eddie Reynoso, there has been efforts to kind of smooth those rough edges with Valdez. Defensively, I know they've been working on his defense a lot, particularly with this fight in mind. Who's the harder puncher? I would edge towards Bichelt. I would edge towards Bichelt being the more polished, and his combination work and his ability just to slip and slide and unleash to the body and the head is when he's in full flow. It's one of those. I mean, I love fighters like Miguel Bichelt. Absolutely adore them, and I think that we're in for a really, really exciting 12 rounder. I lean towards Bichelt come out on top. I think it will probably go the full 12. And I think that it could be one of those fights of the ages. It could be. It's also one of those fights, and I'm loath to kind of criticise anybody for putting these fights together in this current world that we live in, but it is one of those fights where you just wish that the fans were crammed in and they would just add to that cauldron. But I think the fighters will do a pretty good job of keeping things hot and spicy themselves on Saturday
it's
night.
It's a cracker. It's an absolute cracker. Like you, I'm leaning towards Bichelt, and I think the two factors that just sway it for me, besides the fact that Valdez, I think he's just a little tiny bit loose around the edges, is the jab of Bruchelt. Everything works off that for him. He's much more compact and neat and tidy. The punch part is going to be helpful, but it's the jab. And I think also, I know Francisco Vargas was maybe a little bit frayed and torn and maybe shop-worn by the time he got to Bruchelt, but, you know, he's a tough nut, and coming out of those two hard wars on the right side, being in fights like that, I think that can only help Bruchelt in a fight of this nature. I know Valdez had Quigg in 2018, but he had the better of that fight almost all the way through. Although it was a hard fight, it was a hard fight for Quigg. I don't think it was such a hard fight for Valdez. And I think those factors, being in those hard fights, toughened, battle-hardened, and the jab, I think those might just be the decisive factors for Bichelt. I can't wait.
No, I can't. I can't wait. And it's a really, really good weekend. You've got this British dust-up that we've wanted to see. I know Avanesian's from Russia and what have you, but it really has got that kind of British trade fight flavour to it. And then in the early hours, what could be, what we hope, is one of those Mexican super fights of the ages.
And that, and Bruchelt Valdez, tees up perfectly this week's This Week. Yes, and this week we take you back to the 19th of February, 2000. Can you believe it? It's impossible to believe that it's that long ago that Eric Morales and Marco Antonio Barrera went head-to-head for the first time in their careers. Of course, the first leg of a trilogy, Morales defending the WBC Super Bantamweight title for the ninth time. Barrera, who'd, of course, regrouped and was rebuilding his career after those two defeats to Junior Jones, the first of his career. He, at the age of 26, Morales, 23, was defending the WBO belt for the third time. So it was a unification fight. But that really didn't matter. This was, it was about more than just Mexican pride. It was very, very personal, this, Matt. It was about cultures within Mexico. It was about backgrounds and class within Mexico. They'd scuffled at a soccer match just 6 months prior to that as well. Heated exchanges at press conferences. It meant so much to both of them. The build-up was fantastic, but the backdrop to it, the history of the two participants, just an added layer and an ingredient in what was a perfect mix.
Yeah, I mean, what a lovely way to introduce it. Anybody think you should be a commentator? yeah, it was. It was savage from the moment it was signed. It was savage long before that. They didn't like each other. And what is quite rare, they didn't even seem to respect each other at all. And I've looked at this fight this week, actually, in this week's Boxing News. If anybody's been reading Boxing News every week, I've been going through those Desert Island fights where we've been collating, and it's a painstaking task, but collating all of the viewers' votes for their favourite fights from each decade, the one that they would take from each decade along to a desert island. Now, this is a testament to how strong the 2000s were, is that Eric Morales, the first fight between Eric Morales and Marco Antonio Barrera, is only third on the list. But I watched the whole fight again. And the fifth round is probably the best of the fight. Barbaric in the extreme. But then you've got the 12th as well, and it's not funny, but generally boxers will touch gloves at the start of the 12th, and they kind of do, but then Morales finishes it by shoving Barrera in the throat before the final round, and of course there's that slightly contentious knockdown. Morales is incensed that he's been knocked down in that last round, and instead of kind of going back, taking it easy, he just more or less runs at Barrera to try and make amends and level the knockdown count. The whole 36 minutes is absolutely intoxicating. Absolutely intoxicating. If you haven't seen this fight yet, go and watch it now. This is superb. Boxing at its best. And this is why, and everyone who listens to this will know how much I love my heavyweight boxing, but this is why you will get more drama very often, or sustained drama. This is the perfect exhibition of it in the lower weight classes.
Yeah, I mean, I watched it at the time. It was on Sky, wasn't it? But as often with these this week's, the American ones, I try and go back and watch the HBO coverage. And there is HBO footage available on YouTube. It's about an hour and 20. So you get all the build-up, the interviews afterwards, and the fight itself. And it's fantastic to get the build-up, because you get not only what's going on in their lives, but you get a sense of what's going on in the boxing world. You know, they're highlighting other fights that are coming up.
Yeah,
it's a real kind of moment in time. And the coverage they get, it was part of the Boxing After Dark series that they used to do on HBO. And the coverage they did at that period and in their careers was absolutely terrific. And this is just a fight. What a fight. And, you know, we've said it before, and we will do it. We'll do the sort of, we'll do a top 15 of the, you know, 15 rounds and the best rounds, or a selection of the best rounds, like round one, round two. And this round five has to be one of the best round fives ever in boxing history. No question about it. Just fantastic one way and t'other. And just on the scoring, Matt, what interests me when I was thinking about this fight particularly, but the three fight series, because I think there was a feeling at the time that Barrera won this fight. Certainly Harold Lederman, who was a former judge and part of the HBO scoring team, something you've recommended that maybe be adopted in our coverage on boxing TV and media in due course. That's an interesting idea. He was quite wide for Barrera. Basically, it was 1 point either way for two of the judges, and then 3 points for Eric Morales for the other. And bear in mind, the knockdown in the 12th, which made it a 10-8 round for Barrera, that theoretically for that judge might have been a 3-point swing in the fight. So theoretically, you might have got a scoring situation in that fight where one judge had Morales winning that by 6 points. And then you get a discussion very similar to the one we had at the weekend with Zelfa Barrett and Kiko Martinez, where people say, that fight was so close. It was so close and competitive. How on earth do you get 6 points between? And it could have been possible had that been ruled a slip as it should have been. But the amazing thing about the three fight series is that actually they did come up in those three fights largely with scorelines that were one or two either way.
Yeah, exactly, exactly. I mean, and they were exceptionally close fights. I mean, there was talk that the first fight should have gone to Barrera. That was generally the perceived opinion. But I think that all of the rounds were so ferocious and even that I don't think you could really argue too much. And then you had the rematch where the perception was that Morales deserved to win it, and it goes Barrera's way. An interesting aside to what happened a few days after the first fight is that the WBO, with whom Barrera had reigned, in all their wisdom, said, "No, don't believe that. Not having that. We will reinstate Barrera as the WBO champion," which is another discussion. Is another discussion to have. But I mean, ultimately, this was a wonderful. Wonderful fight. Wonderful
fantastic fight. And Nassim Hamed's name, of course, being sprinkled around in all of those HBO sort of super featherweight, super bantamweight title fights of that particular era. And so many, you know, Morales was automatically linked with Barrera, who came into the fight with what can only be described as a Bruce Lee haircut. I was so, Matt, I was thinking of you as I was watching it. I was so envious looking at Barrera's hair. It's magnificent. He looks like Bruce Lee, slightly combed forward, slightly pointy down by the what would be sideburns as well. Magnificent head of hair.
Why were you thinking of me for?
Because we're both challenged in that department and we're both lovers of hair on other people. So it's a great haircut. Who were you? Because at that time, I must admit, it was interesting for me. I mean, I must have watched this fight 20 times over the years, I would guess. I've got it on DVD, even although these days it's easier to watch stuff on YouTube on the telly. But I've watched this fight so many times. But I was a Barrera fan back then. And Morales was, you know, he's my nemesis. He was Barrera's nemesis. And so I've always kind of generally over the years watched that fight as a fan of Barrera, but it was interesting watching it again last night where, you know, up until the last round, I was thinking that Morales was just nicking it, and that knockdown in the last, which wasn't a knockdown, really did, I think, sway things. And in the end, I had Barrera by 1 point because of the knockdown. I had Morales by 1 point. So much more a kind of appreciative of Morales as the years have softened my parochial appreciation of and partisan appreciation of Barrera. And I think that's similar for people who either were for Ray Leonard, as I was, or Duran, or particularly Hagler, I think, as well. You do have a split, not necessarily down the middle, but you do have a split of fans who were either one or t'other. And often that has softened down the years too.
Yeah, it does. And I think what it also highlights is that you kind of, and this is going back again to what I said about the 110 years of boxing news, when you look at what the opinions were of the time, and the opinion always seemed to be, as it is now, is that yesterday was a golden era, today not so much. And the appreciation of Barrera and Morales, Marquez, Pacquiao, around that super bantamweight, featherweight, super featherweight, when they're all fighting each other, the appreciation of that era just continues to heighten the further away it gets. And it really was. It really was a special era. And I guess the moral of the story is that in boxing, most eras are pretty special.
And so the moral of the pod this week has been one of scoring. I'm probably going to get flack. People saying I'm criticising how people view fights at home and sticking up for the board and the judges on site. That's not the case at all. I just want to explore all of these avenues about how we watch fights, where we watch them from, and what impact that maybe makes in terms of how we appreciate or interpret the action that we're seeing. I think these are all important facts, and hopefully we've done a bit of that through the course of this pod. Because it needs to be revisited, I'm sure.
I think completely it does, and I don't think, or I would hope, that it doesn't appear that either of us are taking sides with anybody, really. I think they're all really, really valid talking points that I believe have got to a point now where they need to be addressed. And I think that's really what I want the takeout of this to be. It's just not an ideal situation at the moment. And I'm not convinced that the situation is just kind of grin and bear it, I suppose would be my last word on it. Before, can I just say something in regards to boxing news? Now, I keep referencing boxing news every week. I'm pleased to say that I have got a offer here. If anybody who doesn't subscribe to Boxing News would like 10% off a subscription, then go to Boxing News Online, our website, hit subscribe, and at the point of checkout, just put in boxing in block capitals and you'll get your 10% off. And while I'm on my soapbox, this week we have, as well as the usual reports and previews, there's a wonderful, wonderful feature by Elliot Wurzel, which goes behind the scenes of the life of a sparring partner, where he speaks to people like Dave Allen, Steve Cunningham, and people like that. And there's how a fighter can be persuaded to just become a sparring partner as opposed to a fighter, in that they will realise that they can earn more money as a sparring partner. Then there's the flip of that, where Dave Allen is talking about how he wishes he'd never, ever step foot in a ring to spar someone because of the amount of damage that it's done to him. It's a brilliant feature. You can get that this week. We've got a Craig McEwen feature by Craig Scott, which is a really, really interesting read. Now, the headline of that is Once Upon a Time in Hollywood. And that is when Craig McEwen went over to the Wildcard gym off his own steam. And he was befriended by this little Filipino in a Hey You Jimmy hat called Manny Pacquiao, who just wouldn't leave Craig McEwen alone. So read that. Also, for the historians out there, or from people from a little bit further back, you may or may not remember a British champion called Huey Ford. And he was, he kind of came along at a time where, I suppose, it is different to now, where there wasn't that much fanfare around the sport. But some of the stories that he's got about what he had to do to crash weight just to get in the ring is really interesting. And something that I'd recommend every week, if you don't subscribe to Boxing News, is the Steve Bunce column. And this week, he goes back a year to the build-up to the Tyson Fury-Deontay Wilder rematch. And that will give you insight that you've probably not heard before. It's really, really good stuff. So if you haven't already, go and treat yourself to a Boxing News subscription.
Oh, there's the sales pitch. And actually, speaking of sales or maybe buying, there's one more thing we need to do before we close, and that is the book of the week. This week is over to you, Matt. I'm holding the book that you are going to suggest. I've got it. I've read it. It's a good suggestion. Tell us what it is.
Okay, this book is called This Bloody Mary Is the Last Thing I Own. It's by a now deceased writer, a very troubled writer, Jonathan Rendell. And it takes him through a journey in boxing and his relationship with Colin Sweetsea McMillan. And I think I read a lot of boxing books. I read a lot of content that obviously goes in boxing news. I read a lot of submissions that people send to me hoping to get in boxing news. And when I can see that a writer who can write does so effortlessly, or appear to do it effortlessly, then that is a very special talent indeed. On the back of the book it's a review from the Financial Times, and it says, with boxing, only very good writers seem able to avoid the cliche zone. Jonathan Rendell is such a writer. And that's exactly true. It's wonderful. I mean, his description of Jim McDonald being knocked out by Kenny Vice is wonderful. There's also him in the going and visiting Donald Curry just before he fights Michael Nunn, and it's a real insight into almost that loneliness that a boxer feels and that helplessness at times just before a fight, particularly when perhaps they're not that confident they're going to win it. I mean, Jonathan Rendell is a man that I would love to have met, had a beer with, and really, really got to know. I mean, there's various people that I do know that did spend time with Jonathan Rendell, and they can tell stories that are hilarious and horrific in equal measure. But one of the great boxing writers, Jonathan Rendell, he only shone brightly for a short amount of time, but he really, really does light up every page.
Yeah, it's a great read, and it's kind of like almost like Gonzo fiction, isn't it? It's almost like fiction. it's like sort of Gonzo writing, almost like Hunter S. Thompson, living and breathing the experience while you're writing about it as well. I know a few journalists who were kind of around the time of Rendell who maybe suggested that the lines between truth and fiction maybe were blurred on occasions, but so I think it's only fair to say that. But this is definitely, it's also fair to say that he's a fantastic writer, and it's a terrific read. And there was just one that I sort of looked back on this morning before we came on, and it sort of Frank Maloney's throwing an after fight party up in London, and Rendell goes to it, and there's a few sort of seedy, uninvited characters who find their way into the club later in the night, one of whom's a big dude called Gladiator. And they try and extort some money out of him. And in the end, Maloney makes a call, and a fearsome security guy turns up belatedly at the very end of the story. So there's some great stuff, and you can just imagine sort of some of his experiences, both in and around London and out in Vegas and so on and so forth. So look at that. It's called This Bloody Mary Is the Last Thing I Own, A Journey to the End of Boxing by Jonathan Rendell. It's very much worth some of your time. Thanks to Mike Hills as well for some of his time. He sent us a picture of a mountain lion out on one of his walks listening to the podcast. And we've got a few more of your emails, which I'll get to as well next week. But hope you've enjoyed. Once again, thanks for listening. Take care.